Welcome to the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Dockiel, and today my guest is Howard Beck from Bleacher Report. We got into the conference finals, both Eastern and Western. But before we get started, I need you to do me a favor. Please rate and review the podcast. It's really going to help me out. So, you ready to tip it off? Howard, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Mo. Thanks.
Oh, man. We just got to jump right into it. Great game last, the first great game of the conference finals for both series. Rockets kind of surprised me. I had them left for dead, if you want the honest truth. Going into that game, I wasn't expecting that.
Funny. Interesting, guys. Especially you as a studied basketball analyst who gets into the nitty-gritty of the game. I would have thought you would have resisted the urge to write them off that quickly.
Yeah, it was more just I was kind of not. I'm not a big believer in their ISO offense, and it bugs me because this has been my problem with the Rockets all year. When they first got Chris Paul, I thought we were going to see a little bit more creativity from D'Antoni. I thought we were going to see more. You know, one of them runs a pick and roll early in the clock and then kicks it out to the other guy who then gets to attack a defense that's rotating to him and then go from there. I thought we'd see a lot more action on like the second side of things. And we didn't see it. And to be fair, they did have the best offensive rating in history and all of that. So really I kind of just walked away saying like, well, this is why you're not coaching. But we kind of see it in the playoffs a bit where their ISO sort of struggle. And there was one possession last night that got me really excited. It was, I think, midway through the fourth, and you know, Harden went and attacked. He didn't have a layup. He kicks it out to Ariza. Ariza immediately swings it to Chris, and Chris is finally going to be able to attack off of the Warriors rotating to him. He gets to the free throw line, and right then and there, everybody jumps on James Harden because it looks like he's about to kick it to James, and he finds Ariza for cutting to the basket, which Ariza ends up getting fouled for two free throws. But I was like screaming. I was like, "This is what I've wanted all year."
Yeah, it's funny because at their best they have that, and it's not like all they do is have James Harden stand there pounding the ball into the ground. But it does seem like that is the it feels like that's the quintessential snapshot of the Rockets offense and of this season is, you know, James Harden isolating, pounding, dancing, waiting to trying to get somebody off kilter before blowing by them or stepping back for a three. And so, yeah, I mean, aesthetically, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the way they play, although I thought last night they showed a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
And I thought last night the Warriors showed less than what they usually are, and that's why we got the result we got in part. And Steve Kerr lamented that, noted that after the game, that they had become stagnant. And that's what a switching defense, a good switching defense with capable defenders who can actually, you know, keep everybody in front of them, that's what it can do to you, right? And that is actually Mike D'Antoni's rationale, which I wrote about recently, for why he plays the way he does with the Rockets, for why he's coaching the team the way that he is. It's not that Mike D'Antoni was ever a fan of isolation ball. It's more that, well, if teams are going to insist on switching, and we've got guys who can punish the switch, then that's what we're going to do, and that becomes isolation play, and so be it. If it works, it works. And so Mike D'Antoni has kind of just come to terms with the fact that, well, this is how we will win. This is what's most successful for this team. Whereas Steve Kerr, who among his influences are Mike D'Antoni's old son's team, is ruining it afterwards, saying, damn it, I guess this is where we are as a league. We're now going to isolation play, which is funny because the league spent the last 15 years trying to get away from all of that. That's what all the rules changes were about, or a lot of them were about in the early 2000s. That's what eliminating illegal defense was about.
Right.
You wouldn't have two guys, you know, going mano a mano on one side of the court while eight guys stood on the other side and just watched. And so it's just a weird, ironic twist of events. And I don't think it's a permanent state. I don't think this is where the league is. I don't know if Kerr – I don't think he really meant it that literally. I think it's just more of if everyone's going to switch on defense now, and if you've got defenders who are capable of doing that, then, you know, the onus is now on the offense is to try to figure out a way to combat that without it becoming just a bunch of isolation play. And you know, look, the Warriors got Kevin Durant for a reason. He's the guy who can solve any offensive possession. He's got amazing one-on-one abilities. But that's not what you want as your go-to option. That's not right. What you want your offense to be about. And Steve Kerr's aesthetics and his preferences are very, very clear. He wants the ball to move, and it didn't move enough, and their assists are down, and maybe that's why this series is tied.
Yeah, and you know, it kind of goes back to the idea that not every isolation play is equal. You know, for me, if you run an offensive set that ends up in an isolation play because none of your other options work, like that's a little better to me than the James Harden and even Chris Paul to an extent just pounding the ball on top of the, you know, waiting for the screen and the right mismatch. And I think that's kind of the flow I was hoping to see with those Rockets. And this is just me more lamenting of what I want. You know, what I want. It's me being selfish. This is what I wanted to see.
Well, we all watch it that way a little bit, right? Like it's just like, you know, regardless of other preferences, we want good series, right? So, to some extent, a lot of us who don't have a rooting interest are saying, hey, great, we've got suspense. It's a 2-2 series. We've got, you know, an actual, excitement here instead of the cakewalk that we saw a year ago in both conferences.
Right.
We all watch it with a little bit of selfish interest. And aesthetically, I think you and I agree. Like, I think we both would just rather see two teams that are moving the ball around and having it ping around and movement of players and cuts and, screens. And I think that's a more exciting brand of basketball. And I think that's what a lot of us have been kind of conditioned to over the last decade or so as the NBA evolved out of that kind of sad, stagnant.
Right.
It's like, how did we get here again?
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're here again. This is weird. But in a fun way, it's fascinating. And you had talked about D'Antoni kind of going against what is traditional, you know, offenses and what he'd really like to do. You wrote a brilliant piece of, you know, D'Antoni 7 seconds or more, which is if you followed him during the Phoenix Suns, it was 7 seconds or less. And I'm very impressed with his ability to suppress that and go with that. Cause he's got to just sit there at times just going like, oh, this is killing me.
I think so. And part of my motivation or my curiosity in going to interview Mike for that story was, you know, I'd covered him in New York in his years with the Knicks, and I got to know him when he was still with the Suns, and I covered some of their playoff runs. So I felt like I had a very good sense of who Mike was, what his basketball values were, and how deeply ingrained they were to the point of almost a religious adherence to this is the way basketball should be played. Not just what wins or what's best, most effective. Those things all matter. Winning matters. But also that it was just what appealed to him. It's the way he saw the game. And when he lost playing that way, rather than, you know, caving to any of the public criticism or acknowledging, and he shouldn't have because he was right, but when everybody else back then in the early mid-2000s was saying, your system doesn't work, it's only good in the regular season, it's a gimmick, you shoot too many threes, it's just about guys running up and down the court and jacking up shots, all this stuff, he would just dig in his heels and say, screw you, I know what's best, this works, this is great, and maybe we should even be shooting more threes, and maybe instead of going small, we should go even smaller, and maybe instead of Amari Stoudemire at center, it should be Sean Marion at center. And,
right.
Any criticism, any resistance you put up, any skepticism that came his way about what he was doing with the Suns, he would answer with, you know, you're wrong, and I'm just gonna keep doubling down. And I loved that about him.
Yes.
And by the way, history has proven Mike right.
Yeah.
You know, shooting more threes was the correct option. Everybody's doing it now at a rate that eclipses even the most three-point happy Suns teams that he coached. He was right about small ball. He was right about spreading the floor and about pace. And so because it was such a stubborn insistence back then, because it was like this almost religious adherence where he just wouldn't even hear you speak of anything else that might pour water on his approach, it's fascinating to see him in this other mode. And to see him. So that's why I went out to Houston. I brought Jack McCallum's book, 7 Seconds or Less, with me. I packed up the quotes that I found from back then and said, Mike, what happened? And there's part of me that wanted to see him actually say, you know, yeah, you're right. 2005 version of me would be appalled.
Right.
He wouldn't cop to that. I still believe it. And by the way, you know, when I talked to Alvin Gentry and some others who worked with Mike over the years and who've known him well, they believe it too. They believe that there's some part of Mike inside that's probably screaming and saying, I can't believe we're just sitting here pounding the ball into the ground.
Right.
Mike can't admit that right now. He can't say that because he's coaching James Harden and Chris Paul, and that would sound like he's, you know, criticizing his own guys. Like, that wouldn't, you know, he can't possibly, if he's feeling that, and look, I can't assume.
Right.
But if he's feeling that weirdness that I'm observing across the years here, this contradiction, he can't say it. But I do think he's feeling it on some level. All that said, I also believe that he's sincere when he says, listen, we're still doing a lot of what I've always preached. And the only difference is that because the league has gotten so good at switching and that we've got this kind of defensive, approach that we're having to counteract, that this is the best way. And he knows he's got an incredible offensive weapon in James Harden and another one in Chris Paul. And he wants to win. And every coach wants to win. And to his credit, if he does have these impulses that I believe he still has, uncomfortableness, to his credit, he has suppressed that for the benefit of his team winning games, 65 games, and now, you know, 2 wins away from the NBA Finals. Look, at the end, the coach has got to do what it takes to win.
Yeah.
And that's what he's doing. So all credit to him for that.
Yeah, and he's coaching the players he has. If you have a guy like James Harden, you got to do what you got to do James Harden is going to be the MVP this year. You can't really argue the positive side of what D'Antoni's doing. It's brought in results. So,
yeah.
You know, I do want to talk a little bit about the Warriors on this their side of the game. I mean, it really showed not having Iguodala just from the stamina standpoint. You know, Kerr had said, you know, in his post game that they were gassed and, you know, they didn't get a good Looney game, which isn't all that surprising because this is the Looney that they passed the option on. You know, the way he had played last night, Bell wasn't great. I mean, they just couldn't find another guy off the bench that could kind of help sort of just give these guys a breather. Nick Young was terrible last night. How concerned should we be about Iguodala going forward? We know he's really important to the team, but how concerned are we about this injury?
You know, they upgraded him from doubtful to questionable, which, you know, like, it's all semantics, I guess, on some level. But I take that at least as an okay pseudo-encouraging sign for Iguodala and for the Warriors in that, things were – There was some measure of improvement that made them change the assessment.
Right.
Question.
Yeah.
Going in the right direction. But, you know, it doesn't mean he's going to get there in time for game 5. And it doesn't mean he's going to be himself for the rest of this series. So, look, where you and I are speculating in the dark here medically, I don't know. I don't know how big a concern. I mean, if he's not going to be himself or if he can't come back, then it's a huge concern.
Right.
How concerning the actual injury is, it's unclear. I mean, he banged knees. It didn't seem like it should be that bad. It's obviously not a serious, serious injury. But who knows how long that lingers and what limitations that creates for him. I'll say this. I like one aspect of this discussion in that we all get too caught up, and we're all guilty of it, media and fans too. They've got 4 All-Stars. Nothing else matters. We shouldn't even pay attention to the supporting cast. It's irrelevant. Or, hey, if you've got those guys, you're already you can win. We know stardom matters in the NBA. Superstar talent matters most. But it's nice to get this reminder occasionally. And I know, look, if they lose the series, Rockets fans are going to howl about it being about Iguodala. Like,
right.
Take a break. You've got Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, and 2 other All-Stars. But these other players are important. Real guys are important. When they won that first championship, it was the what was the slogan, all for one or whatever, the, you know,
strength in numbers or
strength in numbers.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, and Iguodala was the MVP of that series with numbers that are way below probably every Finals MVP in history.
Yeah,
because of all the other things that he did, including his defense on LeBron, but also just because he fills up the box score in all these other ways. It's good to get a reminder now and then that your fifth most important player, if that's what he is to them, is still really important. That is not just about superstars. That teams have to construct themselves in a way that that gives them versatility and depth and fills all these other gaps that are not just about putting the ball in the basket. So that's a weird way of trying to draw some kind of positive from Iguodala's injury, but just it struck me at one point last night that they're really missing him. And if you say that, it sounds ludicrous to fans who think, well, why, you know, where are you, got to be kidding me? And I don't have any sympathy for the Warriors, and I wouldn't expect them to.
Sure.
They have a wealth of riches at the top. But as I say, it's a healthy reminder to us that the rest of it matters. The Cavs are that too, by the way. I mean, you know, it's a different discussion there because the guy they lost that's most important was Kyrie Irving, who is a star. But it's a reminder too. Look, LeBron can't do it by himself.
No.
That's the truth of this league. Superstars can never do it by themselves, not when you're talking about winning championships. And even a team with four stars still needs really capable role players to do everything else. And, you know, I mean, the Warriors are so good and have done so many smart, correct things that it's hard to criticize. But this is underscoring, again, the weirdness of their roster construction this season with all these bigs, many of whom don't play.
Yeah, and you know, to the supporting cast point, you know, how many guys don't have championships if Robert Horry isn't on their team? I mean, you know, I mean, the Spurs, the Lakers, the Rockets all have championships because he hit big shots for them. I mean, he wasn't the star player or whatnot. So supporting cast matter and are really important. You brought up the Cavs, so let's just jump right into that series. But before we do that, let me tell you about our friends at Brand Active Media. They're a fun company. They're awesome at corporate events, private parties. They're the ones with the photo booth with several different props. They make great trading cards. So if your kid's soccer team's playing, the little league team, you could put them on a trading card so the kids have their own actual trading card. They've been everywhere. They've been at the NFL Draft, the Super Bowl, the Pro Bowl. They've been at the NBA All-Star Weekend. They've done events with the Galaxy. Check them out, brandactivemedia.com, and let them know the Jump Ball sent you. And now, back to the pod.
Listen, I had a lot of doubts when they were down 2-0, which, you know, is, again, kind of unlike me a little bit, just because I'm always like, I'm not going to bet against LeBron. But the way they had looked defensively in those first two games, I was just like, man, if they're going to do that, that's terrible. After game three, I was back to my senses. This is a big game five tonight. We're recording on a Wednesday morning. What's your feel like? For me, I look at it and I'm like, if I'm LeBron, this is my chance to really, if Cleveland can take this game and if you can step on their throats this game, it makes game six so hard for those young Celtics.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, if it were, you know, just a matter of LeBron imposing his will, we could safely conclude that he's just going to come out, crush them, and bring it back to Cleveland for a closeout. You know, the Cavaliers, we don't know what we're getting from them from night to night.
Right.
You know pretty much what you're getting from LeBron James. He has been spectacular. He's had one of his best postseasons statistically, and he's had to. I mean, I think he's had more 40-point games or more 40-point triple-doubles, possibly both, in this postseason than he'd had maybe ever. But it's just necessary. It's just what he's had to do because he just doesn't have that true co-star, you know. And Kevin Love has been all over the map. He should be that co-star. Sometimes he is, sometimes he's not. But he doesn't have that Kyrie Irving type or, you know, Dwayne Wade of Miami vintage. So it's put a lot on LeBron. And so can the Cavaliers win a game in Boston, a game five in Boston, of course. Can LeBron have a big game in Boston? Of course. We've seen him have many memorable, important games on that floor and win games there. I have no doubt he can. the question remains for the Cavaliers, who's coming along with him?
Right.
You know, what are they getting out of, you know, J.R. Smith or Kyle Korver, who's suddenly become like their third most important player? George Hill could be really critical to them. He should be the guy that's in their top two, three. He should be that sidekick. So it's, you know, it's just hard to gauge this Cavs team, and defensively too. We just don't know which version of them is ever going to show up. And the Celtics, look, if we want to write it off to youth and inexperience at this level, which is fair, I think that that's at least a part of this. Does going home do it? Is going home, is a change of scenery enough to get the Celtics back to where they were in games one and two, or is this more? Is there a tactical part of this where it's like, hey, Al Horford was awesome in games one and two, and the Tristan Thompson adjustment for the Cavs kind of negated Horford? Can they find a way to free him up? Is there a lineup change coming? Do they just need to make shots? Do Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum just need to take better shots? You know, who knows?
Right.
You know, every game takes on its own personality, as we know. But I think that the Cavs are capable and have whatever momentum actually exists. They have some on their side right now. And if they get game five, I don't remember the percentage off the top of my head, but, you know, there is that statistic of when a series is tied 2-2, the game five winner far more often than not ends up winning the series.
Yeah.
So it's critical.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big, big game. And it was odd, as you said, like each game kind of takes on its own personality and challenges. You know, game four, it was weird watching Jaylen Brown really kind of, felt like he was pressing too much. Like he was really trying to, almost unlike him. I mean, he was getting decent looks, but really just kind of felt like these are things, like he was doing stuff that wasn't Jaylen Brown-like that we're used to seeing. And he's been great, you know, through the playoffs. And Tatum really didn't have a great game himself. And I just kind of wondered how much of it was nerves of like, hey, we got to get this game. And I'm curious what it's going to feel like. I mean, listen, that arena is going to be rocking tonight. I've never gotten to go there for a playoff game, but you can feel it when you watch it on TV. That place is going to be just exploding, and I'm excited for the venue. It's a question for me of like, can these guys sort of handle their nerves? You know, we saw in the Rockets game, the Rockets took two haymakers from the Warriors and were able to bounce back. You know, the Cavs are going to have to be able. I can just see it happening where the Celtics are going to come out and just with adrenaline and everything, just get rolling right away. You know, can the Cavs sort of weather the storm and push through it or whatnot? And as you said, you know, LeBron's going to need help. I mean, the 37-year-old Kyle Korver diving on the floor. Kevin Love needs to show up. He didn't have a really strong offensive game in game four, but, you know, JR can't go, you know, missing again like he did in the first two games. It's going to be really interesting. And the Tristan Thompson, Al Horford, you know, battle has just been really a lot of fun to watch for me, just in the sense of like, these are just two big guys just slugging it out. And, you know, I'm just kind of a little bit, I don't even know what to expect. Cause like you said, we don't know what's going to happen from the Cavs. And I don't know. I'm just too excited for the game. I don't even know if I have actual thoughts.
Well, let me start with this. I've covered playoff games in, you know, not every arena. Several of them have not had any playoff games. But I've been to a ton in Boston in the last 10 years, and actually even before that. But Boston is one of the loudest in the NBA by far, one of the most passionate fan bases, one of the most just engaged from minute one to the end, and I've been before minute one. Sometimes it gets loud before, you know, 15 minutes before tip off. Like, Boston's incredible, one of the best crowds in the NBA for sure, and not piped in nonsense noise either.
Right.
You know, like Cleveland has the most manufactured garbage in the NBA. They just crank up the dial to the volume dial to 11, and they scream a lot into the microphone. Which, by the way, like I've gone on this digression, this diatribe before, but like that's a fan base that's now, you know, experienced great success. They've been there for a championship, and it's their fourth straight run to the finals. They shouldn't need all of the cues and nonsense on the scoreboard, trying to get them to cheer or boo. Like,
right.
Fans a little credit. Boston's is almost entirely organic, and in this day and age, organic crowd noise to me is something to be you know, praised and honored. So anyway, I think that it brings up the an interesting just adrenaline issue. You mentioned Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Jaylen Brown missed a couple of dunks the other night where you think, well, they just mistimed it. But when we talk about youth and when we talk about inexperience, I mean, that's – mistiming a dunk, that could absolutely be adrenaline related.
Right.
It could be the intensity of the moment just kind of overcoming you, and you missed the easiest play in your arsenal, right? And we don't know that for certain, but that's the way it looks. And I think – so the intensity on their home court – yeah, we think of it as home court advantage, but it's also just going to be so amped up. They might be over amped up. It might be harder to calm yourself and make the right plays and time your jumps correctly on the way to the
rim. Right.
When you've got all that adrenaline pumping, and it's easier if you're LeBron James, who's been through this a bazillion times. And again, doesn't necessarily mean that one guy will pull it off and the other guy will crumble. But you just don't know how these things are going to affect guys. Which is why I hate making predictions.
Yeah, and the it's great that you brought up the Jaylen Brown missing the dunks, because it really kind of conjured up Ben Simmons missing that big dunk in Game 3 against Boston, and kind of those similarities of just like, you know, he dunks that. That's a it was almost like that would have been the game. Like it would have really kind of sealed it. I'd have to go back to remember exactly when it was, but I remember it being late in the fourth. But it, you know, and that's the same thing with Jaylen Brown. Like, he missed a ton of easy shots, dunks, you know, and all of that. And like you said, it's the handling of the adrenaline. Like, we saw it last night. Warriors go up 12-0 in the first 5 minutes, and everybody, you know, the jokes on Twitter are like, are the Rockets gonna score? And that adrenaline. And I know you've seen it. I've seen it a ton. I've seen it from my own teams, where we'll start out great, but as soon as, you know, that adrenaline does kind of go away, it's like a sugar high. You know, you crash, and then the other team kind of gets back into the game. So it's really just going to be an interesting, just the first 5 minutes, just seeing how they come out, and then the next 5 minutes after that, seeing how they respond when they have that adrenaline sort of drop a little bit. And that's going to be something that's really just going to be fascinating for tonight's game. I'm not asking for predictions.
Good, because I don't want
to
make one.
No, I mean, well, you can't. There's been no rhyme or reason for when the Cavs show up. I mean, they go to 7 games against Indiana and then sweep the Raptors, and that might be more about the Raptors than anything else. And then they put up 2 duds in games 1 and 2. I mean, you can't predict anything with these guys, so it's like, why bother? Let's just enjoy it.
Absolutely. And look, you know, I've said all year, I think this is a really weak supporting cast, LeBron's weakest supporting cast since 2009-10, and I stand by that. So that they're in this position at all, I think, is a, you know, credit to them that they've been able to manufacture this and get this far, despite, I think, some obvious limitations in that roster. And, you know, Tyronn Lue had to drop out players that they made big trades for just a couple of months ago. You know, like, Rodney Hood is just a non-entity now, and Jordan Clarkson is a bit player at best, and, you know, they're getting some good minutes out of Larry Nance Jr., but it's, you know, they've had to tighten this up, because it just underscores that they don't have that many great options. They don't have a ton of depth here, or that true second star for LeBron, and that they're here anyway, I think, is remarkable. A lot of that has to do with the fact that LeBron is just amazing, and, you know, he makes everybody, you know, better. That's his calling card for his entire career. But it's still incredible to see them go from being the 29th ranked defense to suddenly being able to, you know, just shut teams down. It speaks to the unpredictability of that team and of the game itself. And again, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it makes it more fun. I mean, gosh, it felt like we were about to have some really bad conference finals. And now both series are tied 2-2 with a lot of questions. And it can, I mean, the dream scenario is the next few games become close and we get, you know, game sevens that are going to be really tight. And that's going to be an interesting sort of thing. And the kind of the last note for me,
you know, when we talk about those trades, and you're right, like Rodney Hood, Clarkson, they've really disappeared, you know, out of the lineup. He brought, you know, Ty Lue brought Nance back into the rotation, and that's helped a bit. He's been pretty active in the minutes he's gotten, not a ton, but enough to, you know, you got to be able to eat minutes and buy rest for those guys. You know, I still look at those trades as success just because the guys they traded were issues in the locker room. It appeared, at least, and there are all these kind of stories, and they're just difficult personalities, and it just didn't look like LeBron was he was carrying a weight that you could just kind of sense it. And I feel like them making those trades, even though those guys aren't panning out on the court, has kind of at least uplifted the locker room a little bit and have them going. Am I off base on thinking that you think, or is that something you're kind of seeing a little bit?
I'm sorry, say again, which part of it?
Well, just, you know, whether the trades, and just even though those guys aren't producing on the court, you know, getting those other guys, sort of, it was a addition by subtraction sort of thing.
I think you're right on that. I think that there was, I mean, it was multiple levels. Isaiah Thomas, from everything I've gathered, just the locker room did not appreciate Isaiah Thomas.
Right.
Just leave it at that. We saw many signs of that. I don't think that should be a shock. You know, Dwayne Wade, you know, it had ruffled some feathers when he first came in because he was looked at as, you know, being LeBron's guy, and it knocked J.R. Smith to the bench. So there were some chemistry issues there initially too. And Derrick Rose disappeared because that's what Derrick Rose does. He just leaves teams for a while and then comes back. So there were some chemistry things too. That doesn't apply to Iman Shumpert or Channing Frye, who were also, you know, sent away.
Right.
You know, you have to make trades work under cap rules and all that. I think that it was a combination of all those things. But I also think that, look, Channing Frye wasn't critical enough to them at that point. Iman Shumpert was a shell of himself. Derrick Rose was a shell of himself. Dwayne Wade was okay. And Isaiah Thomas was not the old Isaiah Thomas, the one that they hoped they would get. And as we know, he eventually ended up needing hip surgery. So there was a talent issue there too. There was a talent issue, an age issue, production issue. Like, the guys that they sent out, they were all expendable for various reasons. But you're right, there were some locker room issues too, and some chemistry issues. And so even if these guys, but I won't go to the point of saying even if these guys aren't playing, they needed to do it. They needed younger, more talented, or more helpful players. And initially it looked like that's what they got.
Right.
That they're now fighting for their playoff lives and only using, you know, George Hill extensively out of that group and some Larry Nance, I think has to be considered an overall disappointment. And look, those trades were made under duress. They had to do something. They had to save their season. So I'm not blaming Kobe Altman or the front office staff. I like the trades at the moment they made them. I'm not going to suddenly say in retrospect they were bad. It was the best they could do.
Right.
But they're not getting what they needed to from the players that they acquired.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. This is a no prediction podcast, so we're not doing any of that. Howard, if you haven't read it already, people got to go read the D'Antoni piece. But what else do you have coming up?
Yeah, well, the D'Antoni piece is still live on Bleacher Report. That's from about a week and a half ago, but it's still up. I've got the latest Full 48 podcast with Kenny Atkinson, the Nets coach. That's still up. I'm recording a new one, I think, tomorrow. And I've got a big feature on the Warriors that should drop, I think, tomorrow morning. Don't want to say too much about it yet, but excited about it. Story that I really enjoyed reporting and writing. And that should be on Bleacher Reports tomorrow morning, Thursday morning. So hope everybody goes and checks that.
Yeah, we'll be on the lookout for that piece. Howard, thank you so much for coming on.
Always a pleasure, Mo. Thanks for having me.
That's it for our show. Be sure to rate us, like us, leave reviews on Google Play, SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever else you go to listen to your podcast. And you can support us on Patreon.com.